ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kinda heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo makes an important speech on Iran that the media largely ignores, and we preview European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker's trip to Washington this week. Welcome to Foreign Edition. I'm Mary Kissel with the Wall Street Journal editorial board here in New York, and I'm joined today by my friend and colleague, political economics columnist Joe Sternberg, who's calling in from London. Hello, Joe.
Hey, Mary.
So let's start with Iran. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo delivering a major speech Sunday at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Library in Simi Valley, California. It was titled Supporting Iranian Voices. And Joe, this speech, I wanted to highlight it on the podcast today because I think it's particularly significant. And it was overshadowed by a tweet exchange between President Trump and the Iranian leader Rouhani. We'll get to that in a moment. I think that Twitter exchange is really a sideshow. In this speech, you see the Secretary of State telling the truth about Iran, listing in some detail the corruption at the top of the regime, from the head of Iran's judiciary, Sadiq Larijani, who's worth about $300 million, to even one of the grand ayatollahs, Makram Shirazi, known as the Sultan of Sugar, which has generated, the secretary says, over $100 million for him, and Ayatollah Khamenei himself. I'm quoting here from the speech, Joe. Quote, has his own personal off-the-books hedge fund called the Sitad worth $95 billion. These speeches are heard in Iran, Joe. And, you know, kudos to the Secretary of State for standing up and talking about it. What say you?
Well, exactly. Although I think that, you know, one important thing to keep in mind is that although the details might not be widely known in Iran, I have a suspicion that a lot of ordinary Iranians understand exactly what the nature of the regime is when it comes to a lot of these crony issues, a lot of the skimming, a lot of the alleged corruption. So I think that the real value of this, almost, you know, in the way that during the latter stages of the Cold War, there was a lot of value when U.S. officials would get up there and articulate truths that people in the Eastern Bloc already knew about their own regimes. Here, I think that, you know, Pompeo is saying something that a lot of Iranians already know, maybe giving them some new details about it. But I think that the real effect, just this notion that there isn't a U.S. administration that is pretending anymore.
Yeah, that's right. And as we've talked about ad nauseum on this show, you can't have sane foreign policy without examining the world as it is. And if there's one virtue of this administration, we are getting a readjustment there on countries like Iran and China and North Korea. And we're starting to talk honestly about the threats. But, you know, on this point, Joe, of speaking to the Iranian people, much I think like Reagan did over the heads of the former Soviet Union's leadership to the Russian people and others under their control. Another number for you here, one in four Iranians, according to the Secretary of State, about 14 million people, watches or listens to U.S. government broadcasts each week. In other words, one in four Iranians are relying on the United States for real news and good news as well, embedded in the speech. Pompeo says that our government is going to start a 24/7 Farsi language TV channel to give Iranians even more news. You know, this is really just empowerment, Joe. It's empowering people with the truth. It's saying to them, don't believe the propaganda, make your own decisions, and here are some facts to make it with. You know, I love this. I want to see more of this. I think we should open up their internet as well. And let's make that number not one in four. Let's make it three in four.
Yeah, I think that the big problem, the big conceit of the 2015 nuclear deal that the Obama administration led was that somehow you were dealing with Iran as a single entity, when in fact you were cutting a deal with a regime that we have increasing evidence is not particularly popular at home.
Amen.
And so I think that it is an oppressive, you know, by all accounts, very corrupt regime. The question has to be, why should we, as a matter of policy, be trying to, you know, cultivate closer ties with that particular regime instead of perhaps looking for ways that you can, you know, encourage a more honest discussion about the nature of that government. And, you know, hopefully with things like the broadcasting, perhaps empower Iranians to take control of their own fate by having more and more accurate information about what their government is really getting up to.
And Pompeo addressed almost tangentially the Obama administration's justification for that nuclear deal, which was that, look, you know, these leaders are quote-unquote moderates, and if we just get closer to them, we empower them, they'll lead Iran in a better direction. Pompeo says this, quote, despite the regime's clear record of aggression, America and other countries have spent years straining to identify a political moderate. It's like an Iranian unicorn. End quote. You know, we might laugh at that, but it's true. You know, President Rouhani, Foreign Minister Zarif, these guys are mouthpieces for a very brutal and repressive regime. So, Joe, you're sitting in Europe, or rather Britain, in the midst of exiting the European Union. Why does Britain, Germany, and France, why do they continue then to protect the Iran deal when you have the United States so clearly outlining the nature of this regime and its intentions?
Well, I think there are a couple of issues here. I mean, first off, you know, we shouldn't discount the extent to which Europeans really do believe in the virtue of diplomacy here. And I think that, you know, sometimes the stereotypes are true. Maybe the Europeans, you know, pride themselves on taking what they would describe as more of a realpolitik approach to this sort of situation. Now, I mean, you can argue about how real that policy is if it is based on a fundamental misunderstanding of the Iranian regime. But, you know, they might say, you know, we have to do deals with unpleasant regimes around the world, and, you know, this deal is worth it to try to take the nuclear issue off of the table. But, you know, there's also the commercial issue, which is that a lot of European companies, a lot of energy companies, but also a lot of manufacturers like automakers, Airbus, the aircraft manufacturer, have been anxiously eyeing the Iranian market for some time and had thought that that 2015 deal was going to be their opportunity to get back in. And in fact, a bunch of them have already signed deals, you know, to sell and trade with Iran, to open, you know, facilities in Iran. And so I think there's been a lot of concern since Trump came in and, you know, started making noises and then eventually did you know, announce the intention to you know, tear up the 2015 deal, that those commercial links were going to be threatened. And so, I mean, you can have some sympathy for that, but you also have to, you know, remind yourself that they knew as well as we did that this deal had very tenuous support at best in America. There was always a danger that it was going to end up being revised in some way. And so, you know, I think that the challenge for the Europeans is going to be, again, to recognize the world as it is now that you have a U.S. administration that is, you know, isn't keen on this pact, and figure out where to go from there.
Yeah. And it's a pact. It's not a treaty. Let's remind listeners, it never went through the Senate and the formal channels that pretty much every other agreement is supposed to, has gone through and is supposed to go through. Joe, I found the tone of this speech also very interesting. Secretary Pompeo didn't really use the word democracy. He certainly would never use the phrase regime change, probably because I think that would send up red flags for his boss, President Trump, who doesn't like those terms, who thinks that the invasion of Iraq was a mistake and says that often on the trail. However, Secretary of State Pompeo said this, quote, "In light of these protests and 40 years of regime tyranny, I have a message for the people of Iran. The United States hears you. The United States supports you. The United States is with you." End quote. And then he goes on to talk about the United States' experience, what he called shoots of liberty, pushing up through the rocky soil, blah, blah. Okay. This is not the same rhetoric that the George W. Bush administration used. But my gosh, Joe, you can't read this but anything but, as anything but a call for democracy. At least that's the way I hear it.
Right. I mean, I think that, there are two aspects of that. One is this issue of whether you believe that the Iranian regime should change. And I think that you and I can agree that in a perfect world, it will eventually. But there's also this issue of what exactly the U.S. should do about that. And, although people now associate the idea of regime change with Afghanistan and Iraq and the many problems that we've had in those places over the past 15 or more years, it's also true that there was an earlier template where the U.S., by just exerting some moral leadership, by telling the truth, could empower dissidents within oppressive societies to change their own regimes. And there is some history of that happening peacefully, particularly in Eastern Europe. Now, I mean,
sure.
you have to be careful not to assume that that kind of scenario is going to play out in Iran, because these things can also go very differently. But it is worth thinking about the nature of regimes and not being scared from doing that by the thought that if you go down that rhetorical road, it inevitably leads you to the kind of interventions that we went through in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, we can't discuss this topic without nodding to the Twitter exchange that the rest of the media is focusing on, Joe. And that was an exchange between President Trump, who tweeted out very late Sunday night in all caps, essentially a threat to Iranian President Rouhani, telling him never to threaten us again, or, quote, you will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. And it goes on for a little bit. This is in response to really boilerplate language that Rouhani used over the weekend, saying that war with Iran is the mother of all wars. This isn't new. Joe, I think it's kind of a shame that the president chose to tweet this out, because I think it takes attention away, not just from Pompeo's speech, but from really a larger effort, be it Nikki Haley at the United Nations or Pompeo at State or the folks at the Treasury Department that are implementing these financial sanctions, the bipartisan support for those sanctions in Congress. There's a lot more going on vis-a-vis Iran than what the president is tweeting out. And I think it just the tweet took attention away from that effort.
I don't get why he keeps doing this. And this is a pattern again and again with this administration, and it is a real debilitating issue with the foreign policy. The fact that you see important, often substantive progress on a lot of these foreign policy issues, and then Trump can't help himself but weigh in on Twitter and create an enormous distraction that has the perverse effect in a way of delegitimizing or de-emphasizing the progress that he's making. So, on an issue like Iran, there actually is, I think, some progress that's being made in terms of, trying to clamp down or deter Iranian oil exports that will have a potential crippling effect on the regime. And that is, an effective policy tool that the U.S. can implement. And then you have Secretary Pompeo's speech out there, which I think in another world without Trump's Twitter account would have been the big news, this great moment of truth-telling about the regime. And yet Trump can't leave well enough alone and allow those sort of positive steps to take hold. He has to weigh in with this Twitter distraction.
Well, we're talking about Pompeo's speech in Simi Valley, California, and you're listening to Foreign Edition from The Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
The Future of Everything podcast from The Wall Street Journal. An all-new episode coming soon. on Apple Podcasts or wherever you enjoy audio. The Future of Everything Podcast, explaining the world of tomorrow, today.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition. Mary Kissel in New York, Joseph Sternberg in London, and we are turning to our favorite place, well, maybe not so much, Brussels. European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker will arrive in Washington this week for a series of meetings with the Trump administration. The trip comes at an important juncture, high tension between the European Union and the United States, thanks to the Trump administration's steel and aluminum tariffs, and also the president's threat to impose tariffs on imported European cars. So, Joe, this has all the makings of a great drama. Juncker, kind of dour individual, never smiling, coming to Washington to confront an administration that is threatening the well-being of the people he, I guess, should I say represents? I mean, they're not really directly elected. But
yeah,
anyway,
that's
stretching it a little much.
Exactly.
But take my point. This is not going to be a friendly meeting.
And, you know, one of the fascinating things about this is that before this meeting even happens, they are so anxious to manage the expectations down. So, you know, it's not that Juncker is coming to Washington and promising Europeans that he is somehow going to deliver them from Trump's trade talk. You know, Brussels is saying that this is all going to be about de-escalation and just having a friendly chat. And, you know, maybe there's some value in that. But I think that part of the challenge here is, you know, this question of how much Juncker could actually deliver himself in terms of, you know, addressing any of the legitimate trade gripes that America has had with the European Union for a long time. Things like agricultural protectionism or, you know, various services protectionism you know, that are real issues the two sides have been discussing with each other, you know, more or less fruitlessly for years. And, you know, I think one of the things that probably frustrates Trump is that when you talk to the European Union, you are very rarely talking to an individual who can actually solve any of your problems. So I think that, you know, really what's going on with this Juncker meeting is that yet another person who can't single-handedly help solve the problem is going to try to talk Trump out of making a bigger deal out of the problems.
Well, I guess the real question is, what does President Emmanuel Macron in France and Chancellor Angela Merkel in Berlin think? Because ultimately, those are the two leaders who are standing behind the European Union, I think, in driving the agenda, as much as Juncker might think that, you know, he's the man in charge. Those are the two behemoths on the continent. And Joe, is there a realization now in those two capitals that Trump really does mean what he says? When he says he's going to pull out of the Paris Climate Pact, he does it. When he says he's going to put on tariffs, he does it. When he says he's going to pull out of the Iran deal, he does it. So are they starting to understand that when he says, I'm going to, you know, put auto tariffs on to crush Germany's car manufacturing industry? Oh, and by the way, U.S. industry as well, because BMW in the United States is the biggest exporter of cars from the United States. Fun fact there. Do the Europeans understand that? Have they woken up? Do you think Juncker is coming to Washington with some kind of deal?
Well, no. I think that the Europeans definitely get the dangers here. And what's been interesting is that some of them have been quicker to catch on than others. I mean, I'm nursing a personal theory that Emmanuel Macron, the French president, was much quicker than other key European leaders like Germany's Angela Merkel or Britain's Theresa May to take Trump seriously and to start, you know, taking substantive efforts to manage some of the potential damage that Trump could do to, you know, relations between the U.S. and Europe. But, you know, what's interesting on some of this trade stuff is that actually, first off, we have to admit that Trump isn't always entirely wrong. I mean, the notion that you can settle all of these problems with retaliatory tariffs back and forth is very destructive. But if you're actually looking at U.S. or EU trade, you would have to recognize that there are, you know, problems there that the two sides have been negotiating on for a long time. And, you know, so Trump wouldn't necessarily be wrong to want to break the logjam there, even if he's going about it in the wrong way. I mean, I think that the problem you run into with something like Juncker's visit is that there isn't an awful lot that he can offer right now, because the European Union internally is very divided on a lot of these trade issues. They have had a lot of difficulty getting all 28, you know, soon to be 27, member states to sign on to the massive trade deals with Canada and, you know, potentially soon Japan that they've already formally signed.
Joe, wait, hey, on that, listeners might be confused by that. Why is that true? Is it because you have such a variety of levels of development in Europe? Why do they have such a hard time getting them all on board?
Well, it's because you have the same balancing problem that we run into in the U.S., where different regions might specialize in particular industries or, you know, manufacturing or services. And so, you know, the art of negotiating a trade deal has as much to do with balancing your own domestic interests as it has to do with, you know, negotiating with your outside partner. And I think that the problem that the EU increasingly is running into is that you have a lot of these national governments that feel empowered to try to throw their weight around a little bit. So, for example, Italy is threatening to veto the Canadian trade deal at some point in the future. We'll see if they go ahead with that threat. So, I mean, from that perspective, part of the problem here is that Trump is trying to drive a hard bargain with a European Union that might struggle to deliver any bargain. And that could be a great opportunity if he wants to articulate a clear vision where he says, this is exactly what we want you guys to do. But I'm not sure that you can do that just in a series of very angry tweets.
Well, we'll keep an eye on it. That's unfortunately all the time we have for today. Tweet to us at Joseph Sternberg, all one word, and at Mary Kissel, all one word, on Twitter. We love hearing from you. And thanks for listening to Foreign Edition. We'll be back with you on Wednesday.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.